In tech we trust. It's the people in charge we're not sure about. Okay, so episode 18 in Tech We Trust podcast. Four of us on the show at the moment. We may be joined by a fifth later on. We don't know. Rick, buddy, how are you doing?
Hey, guys. I am good. I am awesome. I guess, you know, I'm actually only a little bit awesome because yesterday I was really, really awesome. So I'm like awesome level two. It's really tough being awesome every day.
Why were you so awesome yesterday?
I had an incredible burst of productivity, but I didn't quite deliver that today.
Fair play.
We're counting on you, Rick.
Come
on.
Hey, man.
Are you preparing us for a letdown here? I mean,
Guys, I'm just beat down. I got so much going on in my work role at Veeam. We've got this thing called a kickoff, sales and marketing kickoff, kind of like a pep rally. We get the whole company together. It's just a lot of prep. It takes a lot out of me.
Kind of like a pep rally. Isn't it what we'd call in the UK a piss up?
Don't know.
I think that's probably what you guys call it, which, of course, here, you know, has like weird connotations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it involves like inappropriate areas and bathrooms and private parts. So, yeah.
Oh, fair play. Okay. So, Mark, what are you up to at the moment?
Hey, I'm just sitting here in the California sunlight, basking in the warmth while the rest of the world freezes.
Yeah, actually, it's blowing a gale out here. I've just had to go outside and position the garden furniture in front of the guinea pig cage so that it doesn't blow over. Madness.
So what doesn't blow over? Is the guinea pig cage holding up the furniture or vice versa?
No, vice versa. We have had it once before where it was blowing a gale and we came home and the cage had toppled over and the guinea pigs had got out and the kids were all upset and, yeah, things you have to deal with.
So are the guinea pigs in the cage now?
They are, yeah. Well, we did think about bringing them inside, actually, but I don't want to do that.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Hey, Mark, how's it going with the beer so far this year? Because you did predict this year was going to be the year of beer.
Yeah, it's the year of beer. I've got some great updates going on. My rocket science buddy Tony and I went and we bought malt to do our first lager. We bought a German malt, yeast, and what do you buy? You buy the malt, you buy the yeast.
Barley.
I'll think of what else we bought.
A hop?
Oh, yeah, hops. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, so we bought all that stuff.
Sounds like it'll be great there, Mark.
I can't even freaking remember what we're buying. Yeah, so we went and bought that stuff. We're going to do 10 gallons this time. And the thing that's really fun is my buddy Tony last week, and I walked by his house. Actually, Gretchen, my wife, and my son Brett and I were out for a walk. And he's out there mangling up something in his driveway, and we take a closer look, and he's carving out the insulation from the door of his refrigerator, the fermenting refrigerator, so we can ferment 10 gallons at a time. I tell you, the guy is a beer-making animal. Cool. I'm just kind of his cheerleader, you know? It's just boom-bah.
Hey, Mark, so, what's going on the technology front with you and with your company?
Well, there's stuff that we're not talking about and stuff they were, right? It's the same thing as usual at Quadra Software. We're really trying to pin things to the floor and figure out what we're doing, but it looks like we're going to call it something like big data management, and it's going well. We're engaging very large customers that have huge data sets that really need help managing it. And it's not just managing storage, it's managing the data also. So it's really exciting. The customers that we're talking to, you know, they've all got multiple gates, you know, once you start talking to them. And we're working through that. We've got our first round of funding. We'll be going for an A round sometime in the first half of this year. So we're trying to line up all our ducks or put our ducks in a row. And it's just fun. It's real busy. And, you know, things I can't talk about because they're not really public yet.
And does that frustrate you not being able to talk about stuff?
No, heck no. It just means I have less work to do.
Well, we know Mark historically from the no comments. So,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know what? It is a little frustrating. But on the other hand, while we're trying to figure all of this stuff out, the last thing you want to do is say the wrong thing and have contradictory messages. So, you know, it's fine being patient at this point. You know, you have really one chance to make a big first impression and you don't want to blow that.
In all transparency, Mark, when do you see that kind of public messaging change? Is there any time trajectory? Is that like we're going to start talking about technology in Q2 or second half or whatever?
Yeah, probably the second half. Probably after we get funding. Part of the problem is, right, if we were talking a lot about it and trying to make a big thing about it, right, if we had a number of customers requests that needed support getting things to work out, we actually couldn't support them right now, right? So we need to keep the number of customers we're working with small. That being said, I mean, we're interested in talking to people, we're interested in getting started, but we're not interested in all of a sudden having a problem that, you know, we can't deal with.
Yeah. Hey, Mark, you know, as the company and the product eventually goes GA and things like that, is that when your workload massively, massively ramps up? Or are you massively, massively busy? I mean, I'm not saying...
Yeah, no, it really happens. It really happens when you start to ramp up. Right now, the workload is heavily on engineering. I mean, and that never really stops, but right now it really is, and it's incredibly critical that we get the core technology built and that they don't get distracted, right? And so that's sure. Another reason why we want to be careful about the number of customers that we're working with, because believe me, every single one that we're talking to right now has different sets of requirements and we can't do them all. And even with one customer, we can't do everything that they want, right? So we just have to continue to try to build out the core and get in a position where, you know, when we get funding, we'll be able to allocate resources to getting these different things done. And then the messaging comes about and we try to figure out how to place what we have in customer hands so it's not overly stated, so people don't get the wrong impression, you know, try to use it for the wrong reasons, all those things. You know, it's you absolutely have to have customers and a growing number of them to grow the business, but at the same time you need to be careful that you don't sell to places where it's not a good fit, because then everything goes haywire.
Yeah, one last question maybe, Mark. How hard is it from an engineering perspective then to stay focused on what your initial idea for the product and the platform was and not be dragged off piste by customers saying, oh, you know what, wouldn't it be great if it just kind of did it this way instead, or maybe it did that?
Well, we've got a long enough list of priorities right now, and I think a lot of them have been pretty well thought out. So, you know, as we started, for instance, one of the things that we always knew we were going to have to do is increase the performance, right? And basically every customer that we're talking to says, you know, you need this to go faster. So the engineering's been spending a lot of time. We've seen really great results on the performance improvements we've had. And that was a change in plan, right? We didn't plan to do that until sometime next year, but we did it now. And, you know, so I think for the next 6 months or so, it's basically a shuffling of priorities. And we'll try not to shuffle them too much. But then after that, once you get out there public, and especially once you have a sales force and the sales force is trying to make deals and the sales force, you know, typically every week is going to come back and they're going to have a requirement du jour. Right. And every week du jour, that's a malaprop. But, you know, and you have to really, you know, that's what a lot of product management work is figuring out, you know, what do we have to have and what can we tell people that we will have in, you know, 6 months from now, a year from now, that kind of thing. A lot of what we're building out is going to be core stuff. And then we figure out, okay, do we tailor it more for the media business, for the genomics business, you know, for the EDA business, for the retail business, you know, all these places that are using analytics, right? And so we'll cross those bridges when we come to it. But right now we're building out core.
Cool. Hey, Hans, you up to anything interesting at the moment?
Tying up some loose ends here. I finally filed Q1, 2, 3, and 4 of 2014 to my accountants. He was
there. Now.
Yeah. It took me a whole year to get that in, and tax control people, they don't really like that. So I'm pretty stoked I got that behind me now. Maybe for another year. No, following Tech Field Day, that this week is now Virtualization Field Day 4. They had 3 presentations already today. Man, that's kind of what I filled my day with a little bit of research on the show for tonight. And I'll be at Cisco Live in 2 weeks in Milan. So I'm doing a little bit of research what I want to do there, which activities I want to do.
Cool. Hey, Han, so good job on last week's show. Picking up on the IDC paper about the object storage market, I know you wanted to get a little bit deeper into some of that stuff. Do you want to maybe make a comment or two on that?
Well, we led the conversation with the article, but we didn't actually on the object storage market, and we didn't really elaborate on why we want to talk about the about object storage, because in the article itself, it just shows the IDC graph. I don't even recall how IDC calls it, their version of the Magic Quadrant, where they put the leaders in a certain market. And one of the things you saw from the previous graph of last year is that EMC, although almost still in the same place, had shrunk to a minimal balloon. There were two switches on the top, number one and number two, so-called. But that was really weird to see EMC shrink away from the object storage market. And that was what the original article was about. Now, it appears that this is kind of IDC's fault. And I knew there had to be a glitch somewhere, because EMC just doesn't disappear from a market, especially when it's about revenues that big, and especially in a growing market. So what apparently...
Hey, can I ask a question, yeah. Hans? So just because I wonder inside of me sometimes, how important is the object storage market? And, you know, is it not all going to end up going eventually maybe to the public cloud? Now, I don't really want to get dragged off into that.
What is public cloud based on, do you think? Public cloud is based on object storage.
No, I know, but it's not based on EMC's cut of object storage or anything like that. I'm wondering,
no, but
you know,
what are
these?
There's really big data sets, and I think about healthcare, for example, has really big data sets that benefit a lot from object storage in the back end. So it's almost every installation of object storage, whether it's Scality or DDN or whatever, they're almost always customized to the solution. Because it is, that's what we talked about last week. It's really application-centric storage. But there is a really big market in object storage for, I mean, we talked about a couple of the advantages in the flat address space. But when you speak about really big sets of data, object storage really, really makes sense. And you can't solve that today with anything else than that. And cloud storage basically is object storage. So,
The commodity discussion just can't go away with the big in the scale of this, and you know, especially Amazon storage, which if you look at who's making the most money on it, I have to say they are. So if you look at the whole object storage market, you know, and that is commodity 100%. So I think, Nigel, I think that might be kind of where you're thinking.
Yeah, that absolutely was where I was thinking.
I get that point, but for healthcare, for example, that just doesn't make sense. You cannot put the patient's data for 10 to 40 years on an Amazon cloud storage. This is just not possible. And there's enough – I just give that as the most well-known solution out there. But there's probably 10, 20, 50 to 100 solutions like that, different types of solutions that cannot benefit of putting your storage in a public cloud that is so big. Media, for example, I don't see all the media channels – all the television channels putting all their media in the cloud, and depending on that,
isn't Netflix all in the cloud?
Netflix is, but they do streaming only. They also use the broadband and the internet to stream. So it kind of makes more sense for them.
Okay, fair enough. So you were saying you can't put healthcare records into the public cloud, and I kind of get that from a. You know, you're kind of not allowed to do it, but you were implying that you can't put them in there for 20, 40 years, whatever. Are you suggesting we can put them on, what, Atmos or Isilon or something like that and have them sit on there for 40, 50 years?
Well, no, I not from a product perspective, but from a compliance perspective, that you cannot put patients' health records in a public cloud. that's stuff that just needs to be secured in an on-premises solution, or just stuff that needs to be available. Big files that are in the cloud are not available to be crunched locally. I mean, I'm not a specialist in object storage, but I see a lot of solutions, and I see that there's a lot of revenue that is growing, and that is where the paper actually was, the research was on, is that EMC was shrinking or disappearing from a growing market, and that apparently is not true, and the fault there, or the explanation for that is that in the IDC research, the vendors can choose one product to be included in the research as such. So if you have multiple products that fit that category, in this case, object storage and for EMC, that would be ECS and Atmos, they chose ECS, Elastic Cloud Storage.
Oh, yeah, Elastic, yeah.
Instead of Atmos. It's not that Atmos has no support anymore. It's not that Atmos is dead. But their explanation is that we're probably going to move newer solutions towards the ECS. And that's why we want IDC to focus on that part of our products. That is why there was a shrinkage in their market presence.
I'm not professing to fully understand that. But does that not just make the IDC report not really that good?
Oh, really?
I mean, I can't stand any of these analyst reports these days. We had issues, didn't we, before with the all flash market?
Oh yeah,
I just like the way you come out with that, Nigel. I just like the way you come out and say it straight. They don't do much for you.
They really don't. And we had this with the all flash market a while ago. That if you could put a spinning disk in an array, it's not all flash, even though they're all flash versions. And what's the value in the report? And,
yeah, that was just worthless. That was really stupid.
I don't get
it. Well, yeah, we have trouble getting data, right? And that's one of the objectives that we hope listeners of this podcast can benefit from, is just some extra perspective. And, right, Tech Field Day, another one, get good questions, good answers. One of the things I like to do, look at revenue, right? Are these companies profitable? Are they making money? Are they investing in the products? Those are all decisions that, you know, people can look at and say, okay, these are sound decisions and I want to use. And you have to take it all in. And analyst reports are one of it. But any process to really make an opinion bias, you know, has its faults.
These reports, there is some value in that, but there's only value in that if it is read by people that know what is in there and that can put the dots together. That's when you get the true value. Because I do get that there's a lot of research going in those papers, but it has to be read by people that follow all the papers or all the news. And then we could say, you know what, or and that follow up on the changes. So, for example, the original article, if you only read that, that was it. So the original article in the register, and you saw the shrinkage of EMC, and that's the only thing you read, That's clickbait for competitors. However, if you read the two articles that go after that and explain what really happens, that's the value of people like us in the industry and helping understand that.
And I hope that nobody today in 2015, I hope that nobody does their shopping exclusively from the top right of those squares.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Hey, Mark. When you guys come to market with a product and all that kind of stuff, I bet you are looking forward to all of these analyst reports and getting messed up. Is that something that you'll specifically have to deal with?
Oh yeah, you have to.
Oh,
you have to. It's part of the. It's because some customers require
still
that.
Buy off that.
They buy off it, right? And so, you know, a conservative customer wants to know if Gartner blesses it, or, you know, IDC blesses it or whatever. But there's actually a number of smaller shops that I think, you know, because of the budget that we'll have to work with, that we'll work with first. And these are people I've known for a long time. You know, I've known people for a long time at Gartner and IDC also. You know, ESG is a larger shop. They act more like a smaller one, though. Mm-hmm. You know, so it'll be likely that we'll work with them, but we'll take there are people at Gartner that are talking about the technology that we're involved in, and and they've been doing it, and I'm sure we'll engage them.
So are you schmoozing up to those guys at the moment then?
No. No.
You're like promising to name beers after them and stuff like that?
No. That's a fun... That is a really, really funny idea. Name beers after industry analysts.
Well, you got to taste it. Firms. You got to know if it's good or bad, though.
Yeah. Oh, my God. What would a De Plessis taste like? Oh, my God. I'm telling you, that a De Plessis has to be a very good beer, but it might be a little strong, you know.
a little sharp, maybe not in the alcohol.
You know, who knows, right? But that's a really great idea. No, you got to do that. That's just part of it. But there are other analysts that, individuals that have smaller shops that I think are well known and well respected, and they'll dig into it a little bit more, and they'll spend a little bit more time with it. I mean, one of the things I really like about ESG, for instance, is the labs. Brian Garrett has always done a terrific job at ESG Labs, and it's coin operated, but they do actually test stuff. And you know, so to me, that has merit.
Yeah, I like ESG also. Yeah, you're right. It's ESG.com, not ESG.org.
Oh, being coin operated.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they have to. They have interests, right? And it's a tight, you know, I've not been an analyst, but imagine the other end, right? Where you have to, you know, I don't want to go Nierman on it, but you have to balance the input, control the output, but keep the interests of the organization in mind. I think for what the situation that the analyst industry is in, I think they do, for the most part, a fair job at it. And I do like ESG, to Mark's point. But it's a tough way to balance all that out. You know, it's not as easy as it might seem.
Fair play. Hey, so we were talking about EMC there. It appears as well, on a slightly different note then, that Joe Tucci and the guys at Elliott Management seem to have kissed and made up. Now, we've gone through this loads of times in the past about the whole EMC versus Elliott thing. Does anybody have anything that they want to say on the current situation?
Well, at least it's a public statement now that they're not throwing in the towel, but there's going to be a silence period for a while now. What literally happens last week is that there's two people brought on board as board members that are chosen, or would you say acknowledged by Elliott. It's a middle ground. It's finding a compromise for Elliott to have more power in the board when it makes future decisions. That's the explanation for now. So you won't see that coming back in the news for a while now, but I think it's just giving Tucci a nice exit.
Fair play. Okay. Don't want to talk any more on that then. Before we move on to mergers and acquisitions, and there is a lot going on mergers and acquisitions related at the moment, did anybody see the new IBM mainframe, the Z or the Z13?
My God, it looks like a TARDIS.
Oh, it's awesome, isn't it?
It is incredible.
It's a portal to the Dark Ages.
Well, I probably do agree with that, Hans. It's a fair point. But I think in a software-defined world, right, I just sent a tweet out. I think it's awesome that something like that can still look so flipping awesome. Yeah, so
2 weeks ago, or actually at our New Year's Trend show, we used IBM as an example of a company that is throwing out everything that is hardware, from chipsets to servers. Laptops have been gone for a while, and now they're bringing in the big beast again. And you know what? It makes sense. That's the flippant problem. They brought in a mainframe, the first one in over 3 years, and it makes sense. So what is a main? Why are we not using mainframes as much anymore in our regular enterprise industry? It's because we have the blender of virtualization, that there's too many workloads coming together, and a mainframe is not suitable for that. For what is a mainframe really good? Doing a lot of the same shit at the same footprint. and that's what's happening here. So they're focusing that this new mainframe for mobile transactions. And guess what? There's a couple of billion mobile transactions going on a day. So it actually makes sense to bring the mainframe back for those specific solutions.
Yeah, if you've got like a website, or if you have order fulfillment, and if you're anybody who's in the, you know, if you want to scale something to 2.5 billion transactions per day and you want it quick, you know, they say the mobile economy, so the experience factor has to be good, and real-time encryption and a really awesome case. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
So it does make sense. They're expensive, but are companies going to build apps that are going to run on this platform? And they're out there. And maybe companies are at a point where they're going to either reinvest or go another direction. They have a really good reinvestment option right now.
You know what, though? Apparently, it cost $1 billion in development. And if that's the case, right, I want to know, how many of these beasts do they have to sell before that makes financial sense? I mean, $1 billion. I didn't think that there were that many mainframes still out there.
IBM's got a lot of money, though. You know, it's like an airplane. There's a sales number. Like, for example, the A380, they need to sell a few more to make the whole program profitable still. Right. And then other aircraft, right? It's a very heavy R&D effort up front. But, you know, a mainframe really is the airplane of your data center.
I get that. But airplanes are still massively, massively in demand. And we don't have an alternative to it other than a boat or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whereas it's totally different for the mainframe. I really thought that that was a shrinking market.
I'm not sure Rickatron is that far off. I mean, if you look at the A380, how many of them would have been sold? Do you think they could develop an A380 for less than $1 billion on development?
No way.
No way.
So
no,
how many A380s are there actually sold? Would that be 100?
No, it's like 184.
So 184, 200? I think there's at least 184 or 200 solutions in the world or places that could benefit of this new mainframe.
Sorry, 147. I had the number wrong. That was pretty good off the top of my head.
See,
well, and
150, you know, machines that have at least cost more than $1 billion in development, that airplane. So, yeah, I think it's
there's
possible.
There's a lot more mainframes out there, too. So it's like there's an R&D investment. There's an addressable market. IBM knows what their market is. So it's a calculated risk. And they also set a goal. They want to do all these extra things, right? So that's why maybe it takes that $1 billion investment, and IBM can take those types of risks, right? So they have an addressable market. They maybe have said to their clients, hey, you know what? We got this 13 coming. You're going to want to hang on to this platform, and let me tell you why, right? They've probably had those conversations, and I'd have to imagine there are at least 1,000, 2,000 active mainframes in the world. It's got to be more than that.
Yeah, I just made a huge calculation error here comparing one plane to one mainframe in the cost. So I think that's not going to be right.
What, the mainframe's more expensive?
No, I said there's going to be at least 150 mainframes because there were 150 planes being sold for
well,
that. But,
no,
so,
I'm looking for, but you know, the A380 is the mainframe. Look at all the airplanes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Look at all the servers. Okay. For every, you know, A319 or Boeing 737, there might be one mainframe. You see where I'm going with it? For all, you know, it's like there's one of those on the airport at any time. There's one A380 on the ground, but you got dozens of every other type of aircraft. You see where I'm going with it? You don't see a data center full of mainframes. That's what I'm getting at.
Well, it's kind of interesting the way, you know, this industry, you know, goes through cycles, right? You know, distributed, consolidated, distributed, consolidated. The mainframe represents the ultimate in consolidation.
No, I disagree. Because the mainframe is not going back to something. The mainframe is now.
I didn't say
just,
that.
Just no. You say we're
say
going
that.
Around in circles. And
no, I say we got cycles.
Yeah, cycles. Then circles or cycles. We're not going back to a consolidated. It's just one niche market that needs this consolidated solution. It just doesn't make sense for the others.
One niche market? Yeah, they are not selling this. They are not selling this for a niche market.
Yes, yes, they're literally.
No. They're selling this for internet commerce.
It's a very addressable market.
Yeah. But I mean, it's a corner case solution.
Of all I can spend, yes.
I bet IBM is not selling this as a corner case with $1 billion invested in it, and that's just the investment in R&D. When you get done thinking about the investment in the sales that are going to go into it, it's bigger than that, right? They're not going to be selling this as corner cases.
They wouldn't do it if it wouldn't work either.
I'm thinking of investing in one for doing analytics on our downloads and stuff for the podcast.
That's right. We'll have it done in five seconds.
That's a lot of what this is going to be. I think as you see this product come out and what IBM's going to do with it is they're going to talk about the analytics technology that's built into it. You know, they're going to talk about how you use this for big data processing. They want to sell this for everybody that's doing data-driven processes. And it's, you know, and they're going to, the arms are going to open wide and they're going to try to get after everybody, right? Everybody that's got any, you know, large amount of data and, you know, just, and doing big data, doing analytics, they're going to try to sell this to them.
And they'll probably succeed. They would not do something like this if it wasn't going to work. They know better than us.
You know, so it's interesting, right? They jettison the server business because it's getting to be too low margin. They can pump all kinds of value into this mainframe, which is basically, you know, a super, super, super server, right? So what is IBM doing with servers? This, the Z13, and it's going to be loaded up with all with their best software technology, you know, to add value to it.
I agree.
Now, the interesting question is, does that devalue this all the software that they've been working on, or does it help, you know, bring attention to it? It's going to be really interesting to watch.
Well, it might all converge. Maybe this is why they've invested in some of this stuff. Maybe this is going to go a direction we don't even see, where it's going to bring it all together.
The hyper-converged mainframe.
Well, that was the point I was trying to make. I mean, this is the ultimate in convergence, right? It's not just hardware. They're pouring everything they've got into this, I bet.
Yes, for single workload solutions.
Absolutely not. You are out of your mind. It is not single workload.
What do you mean by single workload, though, Hans?
Yeah, what do you mean?
Well, it's
very specific target type of workload, not the Blender that we have today.
As in, it's a transaction processing machine. Is that what you mean?
Transactional, very small, billions of the exact same thing to do. This is not meant to be an all-purpose type of storage.
I disagree.
It's a very specific workload type of storage.
I have direct experience. A mainframe runs your business. It's your enterprise resource planning. It's your point of sale. It's your resource management. It can be your time card. It can be your payroll. It can really run your business.
And I have worked at a financial institution.
I'm not sure. That's what it used to be. I'm not sure because it's the same type of architecture that it's going to be the same solution.
I'm not sure that it is the same architecture. I really wonder what the software architecture is like in this thing. It'll be, you know, there's not much information out on it yet. It'll be very interesting to see, you know, whether or not they advertise this thing on Super Bowls or any, you know, but you know, who knows how we're going to find out about it, but it'll be fun to watch.
And with an awesome TARDIS looking exterior like that, they should advertise it on the Super Bowl.
I know. Yeah, they should just put a show on Netflix.
Hell yeah!
I am the doctor.
Exactly.
Should we move on to mergers and acquisitions then?
Since we can't agree on that one, let's go on to the next one we can't agree on.
But this kind of pivot is to something the exact opposite, right? So I think in mergers and acquisitions, first up, let's look at the NoSQL space with Basho and MongoDB, right? And looking at these guys, could they be any different from a mainframe, right? I mean, MongoDB, I've worked for a company that was a big MongoDB user, actually, and, man, I mean, that was, and the whole NoSQL movement is so different to a traditional transactional-type database like Oracle or SQL Server. It's just, I don't know, crazy technology. So we're pivoting from mainframe, super high, low latency, transactional based system to super modern, funky, wears platform shoes and flare jeans, MongoDB.
So for not database specialists, as I am not one, give me the biggest difference between those NoSQL solutions from a solution perspective. How do I look at that? Considering I understand how an Oracle DB works, I understand how a SQL DB works. What's the biggest difference for a NoSQL solution? Where does that fit in?
Right. NoSQL, just think eventually consistent.
That is a very good point.
Whereas transactional databases are all about get everything lined up right away. Boom. We always know the state of everything right away. The MongoDB, the NoSQL is, well, eventually we'll get it right.
Yeah, and consistency was the big question. So the company I worked at that were quite big Mongo users, the guys that sat in the bay of desks opposite me was the corporate DBA team. So there were two Oracle guys and three Microsoft SQL Server guys. And these guys would lambast against Mongo all the time. It's not a proper database. What's all this eventual consistent?
I can only imagine the spitballs that were thrown around there and the banana peels left under people's chairs.
It totally was like that, right? And, you know, a major organizational difference was as well that we had a team of DBAs that looked after Oracle and SQL Server, but the guys that looked after Mongo and that sprouted the project originally were application developers. So they weren't DBAs either. So the DBA guys are like, it's not a proper database. It doesn't do consistency. It's just a big, you know, it's a big file that's got a bunch of key value pairs in there. And it's run by a bunch of developers that aren't even DBAs. Good luck with that.
Yeah, they probably like Docker.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, totally. So the developers that were looking at MongoDB were also looking at OpenStack and Docker and stuff like that as well, which was just a totally different mindset to the corporate DBA guys. But I'll give you this as well. Another massive difference, and this is not technical, massive difference is cost. I mean, Oracle, holy cow. I mean, that costs an arm and a leg, right? And then
let's
Mongo.
Let's throw IBM in there, too, since we were just talking about them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's one of the Z13 is going to be about, it'll probably be more expensive than Oracle.
Yeah.
Well, but Oracle is one of their leeways into a whole market that doesn't want to pay for Oracle. How much success would NoSQL have or have had already if it wasn't for the cost of Oracle?
Yeah.
Well, no, that's
a great question.
That's bringing the question back to pure technology and interest. Would the interest have been and would the need have been that big for those NoSQL databases if not Oracle or classic SQL weren't that expensive?
So Oracle created the problem.
Yes, Oracle
created the opportunity. I'm not sure they created the problem.
Oh, sure. Yes,
the answer is yes. And think about a website like Facebook where something gets input into Facebook and the system is so massive there's no way to synchronize everything. Right? So you have processes that are eventually consistent. And think about, you know, how large, I don't know, cloud programs work where you know, Netflix or something, right? Where eventually every node, you know, eventually the information gets to where it needs to be redundant. But in the meantime, you know, if you made everything be consistent, it would be too slow. And well, to your point, also too expensive.
Comes to the requirements, right? Is a requirement for real-time every node consistency a requirement? Oracle can do that. Good example is I was gotten a haggling match on Twitter one time with someone, and they're like, I need to be able to roll the data, all databases, back to this hour, this minute, this second, this millisecond, and if you can't do that, you can't meet my requirements. NoSQL probably can't do that, but it comes down to the requirements, and if there's money and life and all those things on the line, maybe there's a requirement. So again, there's more stuff. There's room for all stuff.
Yeah, you can't do that with MongoDB or the others either. You can't specify a rollback time. You can kind of get back to a state, you know, something like what it was, and cross your fingers and hope that it's good enough. And so it has to be applications that you can live with good enough and not perfect.
Facebook is one.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of cloud applications where that's true. It happens to not be true for transactions.
Well, those cloud applications are growing all the time. That's a real growing market. You know, cycling back to your original question there, Hans, you know, does it come down to cash? Well, or cost of running the database and buying the licenses and all that kind of jazz. Where I worked, the company that started deploying MongoDB when it was still called 10gen back then, cost was a massive thing, I will say that. They were looking to cut costs all the time, and there was no way that they were going to start shelling out for more Oracle licenses and things to run these development systems on and the likes. But I'll say as well, it comes to what you were saying there earlier, Mark, that these guys scale much better because they're not necessarily transactionally consistent, yeah? So the company I worked at, it was a mixture of cost. They were looking for scale that we really were going to struggle to get out of a traditional SQL-based database or SQL-based. And also, you know what? Mongo is so flipping simple. I mean, I know nothing about it, right? But I sat down with the guys and we spun up, I think, 3 nodes and we got replication going and stuff like that using about 6 commands and in about 10 minutes. It was so simple. So the developers that are developing these new style of apps, They just download Mongo. They spin it up. They learn it in 5 minutes. Scales nicely for them, and it doesn't cost anything unless you want support.
You know, Hans, when you first asked the question, you know, is it because Oracle costs too much? Like you kind of flash. I laugh because I think it's hilarious in the way that some companies and some industries miss opportunities. So you could say, did Oracle miss this one or not? Right? They bought NoSQL at one point, right? And they could have done a lot more with it and been a part of this growing market. And maybe they still will. But I think the cat's out of the bag and it's going to be very hard for them to compete. And maybe it would have been impossible. But I think you could look at these things. You could say that the NoSQL databases don't cannibalize the sale of Oracle transactional databases because the requirements are different. Oracle probably could have been in both businesses. But because of the way they're structured, you know, and maybe those businesses don't generate, maybe that those databases don't generate enough revenue to be worth Oracle's time, but over time they may become the lion's share of what's sold for database licensing. You know, it's like the railroad companies not getting into airplanes. Did Oracle just really blow this one? You know, because of their stockholders or their paranoia about stockholders looking for revenue per employee and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, the only question is how long can you stall it, right? When is the point you need to follow before you become irrelevant?
Yeah, I mean, I see it as a different market than transactional databases. I think eventual consistency is a different type of model, and it's not going away, and it's growing, like Nigel says. Yeah, we'll always have that.
Yeah. Okay.
So how do these guys make their money then? Because MongoDB, they've raked in over $300 million. And so far as I see it, with it being, I could be wrong here, right? But I'm pretty sure it's an open source product, right?
Yep.
Is it all on services and support? It must be, right?
I believe so. How much have they taken in?
Well, they took $80 million just the other day.
And as an investment?
Yeah, and that took them up to a total of $310 million.
Of investment dollars?
Yes. Yeah.
But not sales?
Oh, no. Sorry, no. Yeah, this is, I don't remember which round of funding it was for them. Actually, check this out, right? The other company that we mentioned on the mergers and acquisitions there was Basho, right? So they just took in $25 million in funding, taking them to a total, right, of $60 million after, hear this, 7 rounds of funding.
Yeah.
How many rounds are you allowed to have?
F round was an F round.
Yeah.
They're all very small and modest rounds. That's how they went. The only problem you have with a lot of very small rounds is that there's a lot of dilution going on.
What do you mean by that, Hans? I'm not sure.
Dilution of the stock value. There's a lot of shares to share with after seven times.
A lot of key stakeholders are injected.
Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, on these values here, right? So Basho, $60 million in total, and you know, you compare that to MongoDB, $310 million in total. You'd think, oh, Basho, $60 million, that's pennies, right? And I'm not skewing the conversation here, Hans, onto containers. But I think
every single episode, there's nothing in the whole agenda of today that would even remotely go into containers, and he still
To put this into context, how much money do you think Docker has raised so far?
I don't even care.
No, but the
I bet 50 million. I bet it's not that much.
So it's about 66 million, I think.
And I'm a good guesser, by the way.
Yeah, but the huge bubble that's around that, and I remember looking at that thing, it's 66 million. Where are they going to make money? You know,
it's your
bubble. It's an open source project. But MongoDB, 310 million. I mean, they must think that's going somewhere.
Well, the opportunities created by Oracle.
Mongo makes that on a sale to a larger company that wants to add that to their repertoire, which is weird because it's open source and all of them can use it anyway, right?
Well, somebody
look at IBM, right? IBM could say, we could buy Mongo or we could just use it. Mm-hmm. It's open source. You know, VMware, the same thing. Microsoft, the same thing. Microsoft's going to need something like this at some point.
Yeah. Hey, so I love the innovation, right, that comes out of the open source community. I think, to be honest, in my opinion, the open source community drives most of the innovation in technology today. But is it a viable business model? I mean, you look at Red Hat, right? Been around for years. And they've done okay, right? But they're nothing stellar.
Red Hat does, if I'm not mistaken, $3 billion.
But what about profit?
$3 billion a year in sales?
Yeah.
Really?
I think
is it that big?
Yeah. I think I'm not that far off. If I am, I will set the record straight next week. But if I'm not mistaken, they're doing about $3 billion on revenue.
But what about profit?
I don't know. I mean, $3 billion is a big number as a company in revenue. Yeah.
I believe they are profitable. I don't follow the stock, you know. But
I'm not saying they're not profitable. I'm just thinking. They've never been, in my opinion, and I like them as a company, right? But I don't think they've ever been stellar, have they? And they are the kind of, you know, the open source meets enterprise.
Darling. Yeah. Here's a quick look at the numbers. Revenue from Wikipedia, $1.5 billion U.S. dollars. Net income, $178 million. That's turning 10% margin.
Yeah.
6,500 employees. I think they're doing all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing fine. Yeah.
Fair play.
So,
$3 billion mark was by 2016. So, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they can probably get there.
It's pretty ambitious.
Well,
yeah, doubling their business in 2 years, basically.
But there's a lot going on in the business where they are today.
No, there absolutely is. Exactly.
They do have somehow the middle ground on everything that is happening. Everything that is happening around them. They just have to take the opportunity.
Do they have a NoSQL database? They'll probably be acquiring one of these companies.
I don't know if it's theirs, but I know they push MariaDB.
Yeah, they'll probably acquire something and bring it into the fold.
Hey, don't they have some funky names in the NoSQL space? I mean, there's CouchDB, I think, as well. MongoDB, MariaDB.
Because I made it on the couch. That's right. They come up with these beautiful names. They are good.
Did you just say I made it on the couch?
That's got to be how they came up with the name. I'll look it up. Keep going.
Hey, also on mergers and acquisitions then, Citrix and Sanbolic. I don't know that I can get excited about this. Anybody else who can?
I have never seen the solution hands-on from Sanbolic, but I have heard a lot of good things about the team and about people that have seen it. It's just a weird move from Citrix buying a storage company.
Yeah, I don't believe Citrix will understand the storage business and do anything right there. Yeah, I think Sanbolic will die there.
Like SenServer?
Like a lot of things do when they get to companies that don't understand what they're doing.
Like SenServer?
Well, yeah, well, that's really interesting because my question is, is Citrix, are they on the rocks at the moment? Is there anything good going on at the moment at Citrix? Because ZenServer, I'm sorry, but it is a very poor second best to vSphere and KVM. CloudStack?
It's not even second best. It's fourth best.
Yeah.
I think Citrix is doing really well in their core business of ZenApp and so on. And I mean, everyone that I know that is close to Citrix knows that they're really doing a play there. I'm not sure all the business around that has the same value.
And can those extra businesses then be detrimental to the overall core business where they're doing well? You know, are they bloating their portfolio and dipping into markets and technologies and things that, like we seem to be suggesting here, they probably don't understand so well? Is that going to have a detrimental impact on the things that are doing well?
It depends. Not everything that VMware has tried has been turned out well. They still, their best product is still ESXi as such. I'm not sure. Sometimes you just have to dip your toes and make a bold move. Buying Symbolic is probably not going to hurt them if it fails. And if it succeeds, they could be onto something.
Well, to play it out this way, what Citrix has always been really good is access, remote access and the like. Okay, forget Zen Server, but Zen Desktop VDI is an interesting space, but they actually still do okay there, and it runs on a lot of things. Play in something like Symbolic and imagine user policies applied to storage. Right, they might be able to leapfrog the infrastructure, do some cool things. I don't know. That's just a total guess. Maybe it'll work. Quick fact check that I came up with. CouchDB did not come from the name of being made on the couch by some smart person much smarter than I. However, it is an acronym for cluster of unreliable commodity hardware, and I like love it.
My couch resembles that. So getting back to the Symbolic thing, right? Why the deal? My guess is Symbolic needed an exit, that it was done and over with. Not making money, not getting investment. They just had to sell. And Citrix turned out to be the company that took them out.
Am I right then inferring that because they haven't announced how much that they've acquired Symbolic for, then it must therefore be a low number?
Because it's not a braggable price, right?
No,
I believe that's correct, yes.
Because I think there's a cutoff point, isn't there, where it's a certain number, you then have to declare it, suggesting if it's not a high number, you don't have to. Therefore, if you haven't, it mustn't have been a high number.
Yeah, you might be onto something there, Nigel. I mean, it just looked to me like a pennies on the dollar sale with no hope of further investment or success. That's the way I read it.
Maybe there's some patents that Citrix would acquire. Who knows?
Maybe somebody knows somebody, has pictures. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe somebody knows something, because everybody who's written on this really doesn't know anything about it. And it's kind of interesting, but maybe it's where we're going with it, but maybe not.
So I like that, Rick. Everybody who's written something on this really doesn't know about it. And, oh, hang on, there's four of us here talking about it.
Wait a minute, are you talking about analysts?
well, no, I'm just saying. Well, I mean, and I did a quick look here. Symbolic has, let's look it up. Symbolic does have a few patents for patents, shared storage journaling, volume management, multiple computer storage, utilization of memory for storage. You know, maybe Citrix is playing that in to where they're going with it. You know, that might be part of it. Maybe there's a piece of technology under the hood not working where Symbolic is using it. Maybe Citrix has an idea. We got to watch it.
But those are all storage patents, right? And we've just been saying Citrix are not a storage company.
Well, what if they can do these kind of things on an agnostic manner? You know, they might have an idea. Yeah, it might be worth a try.
Maybe.
Maybe they'll go after EMC now, who managed to bypass Symbolic and Genesis.
Okay, gents, we are approaching kind of the hour mark, not far off it now. Anything for anything else?
There was one more in the merger and acquisitions, and it's actually a spin-off. SanDisk is spinning off NextGen. And NextGen is something they acquired through Fusion.io, and they're now spinning it back off as in a dedicated company. Again, same people, same founder, CDO. So they were like, and apparently someone at SanDisk said, well, this is a hybrid solution, and we don't do hybrid solutions. So back to being an independent company. And for the people that don't know, NextGen is founded by the people of Left Hand Networks. So after they sold Left Hand, they kind of started working on a new platform that has its basis, the same ideas in how Left Hand was made, the same people just took the next step they probably couldn't take with a beast like HB and go build next gen, sold it to Fusion.io. Fusion.io got sold to SanDisk, and now they're spinning off to an independent company again. So looking forward to hearing more of that, because this is not a new company. This is people that actually know what happens in what they're building.
So you think it's one to watch?
I do think these are at least people that deserve the doubt.
Fair play. And I would buy into that, you know, about people. If it's got good people there who've got a good track record, know what they're doing, then, yeah, they're worth keeping an eye on.
And have building on this product since 2008. So it's not something that they're spinning out of SanDisk. No, it's the same product they've been working on for about 5 to 6 years now, and has been used by customers. So it's not something completely new. It will give them a new focus dedicated on their platform.
So here's my take on it is that the technology has been starved, investment starved, ever since going into Fusion.io. I believe that's probably the case. Fusion.io may have continued to spend money on it. Probably not. I'm not sure about that. My guess is SanDisk didn't spend any money on it. And now, now NextGen's going to have to go out and raise a bunch of money to get their technology up to where it needs to be. And the question for investors is, do you want to jump in to this technology when there's a lot of similar things that seem to be maturing pretty well? Is this something you want to get behind? Right. And that will be quite a challenge for the next gen guys. And you talk about dilution, Hans. They're going to get diluted pretty heavily.
That could make sense. I do agree on VCs coming into a market where there's already a lot of competition going on. But you and I both know that people with a track record, they tend to know their ways in and out of VC offices. This will probably...
Yes, they do. The VCs roll out the red carpets for them.
Not entirely, but you know, I mean, water flows to the ocean.
Let's face it, these guys are walking wounded.
This we got Gabriel nowhere. On the show.
Hey. I'm telling you right now, nobody will know or even remember this company in 2 years because they won't exist.
That's profound for you there. There you go.
I'm telling you right now, there are this space is so saturated. There's so much competition. It's fairly cutthroat. If I'm a VC, I look at this and say, there's no way I'm touching these guys. Not only were they bought by one, they couldn't do anything with it. They moved to another company when the parent got purchased, and then they wanted nothing to do with it when SanDisk is looking to get into kind of probably working in the array space. That says a lot.
Well, Gabriel... Are you like in a public space again, like at you know, like a city?
Yeah, I'm in a hotel. I'm in a hotel in New Orleans. And I'm like in a corner. Like I'm at this place where they're like making new tile to lay down. So I'm in New Orleans for a week, doing some technical discussion, and then next week I'm in Atlanta, and the week after that I think I might be home for a day or two, and then I go up to PEX, and then I'm doing a big EBC briefing about hyperconvert. And I'm just busy.
You know, we really don't care about your future itineraries, but we do wonder about you being the bringer of background noises.
Yes.
I am the bringer of background noises. I'm not sure how bad it is here, because I'm like literally in a corner. I'm like whispering into my little microphone port. I figured I would at least try to join the show towards at least some point of it where I had an ability to kind of like shuttle myself away. But at least we don't have clinking dishes. Instead, we just have hall noise and whispering in the background.
It was really refreshing to have you barge in with the flamethrower on full.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, well, you know, I think that there are a strong number of companies out there today that are what I would consider walking wounded or the walking dead. They have a strong product portfolio. They don't quite have enough business to get to that magic 100 million run rate that allows them to go IPO and move forward. But they will continue to muddle along until they get supplanted or they simply die off.
There we have it. I think that's a wrap.
I do too.
Captain's log. Captain Dogger, HMS Containerizer. Entry number 27, a failed experiment. The crew's been ashore on leave and they were doing their best to keep the local taverns in business like they do. And all the talk in the taverns were a strange rumor. Talk and whisperings of putting containers on windows. A ridiculous idea, if you ask me. Windows are for looking out of and keeping the rain and the wind out. They're nae for putting containers on. So I thought nothing of it. But by the time was 3 days back at sea, the men wouldn't stop talking about it. Desperate to try it out. Now I've a firm control over the crew on board, but they wouldn't stop bothering me about it. Captain, can we try some of our containers on top of windows? We want to be the first in the fleet to do it. And it were starting to distract them from their regular ship duties. So I tells them, aye, go and give it a try. But I told them this. They'd be using the windows from the crew quarters. And if there be any damage, they'd be the ones that be cold at night and getting wet when it's raining. On no account were they to use any of the windows in the captain's quarters. So what do you know? They removed every window from every crew sleeping berth on board. Madness, I says, but they says they's doing it for the best of the fleet. So we selected two of our containers, the lightest we could find, each one with just a shell inside. Why the men insist on keeping shells in our containers be a mystery to me. I means we'll live on the sea and there be seashells everywhere. I mean, some of the men, they even name some of the shells. Bash and Dash and Zed Shell, I dunno. Anyway, they be laying the winders on the deck of the ship and they be trying to lower the containers onto them. Every time, crushing that damn winder underneath it. They tried laying the winders flat, stacking them on top of each other, standing them upright. But it were nae use. Every time the winders smashed. Well, now there be nae winders aboard the ship. Well, except for the ones in the captain's quarters, that is. So the men are all solemn and downhearted now, not to mention freezing cold at night. You see, so excited they was, and now all a full of misery. Feel like failures they do. Now, I's not saying that containers on winders can't be done. I'm sure it can. But I's told the men, we needs more information. How it's gonna be implemented. You see, there's no detail yet. Close log entry.